of wisdom, or point of liberty. It's to remember that we are not binding the consciences of others on things where God has not given. Why? When we do that, we either give a, when we bind the consciences, when we teach things that God hasn't taught, we either give a false sense of security, I'm okay because I kept this rule, but it's not something God commanded, so it hasn't actually accomplished anything, or we damage consciences by giving further damage and control to people, that making them unable to have peace in their life. But the point of all of this, though, we want to think about here as we kind of come to the end of this section, is to remember that freedom is not the end. And this is an important aspect. I think this is part of the reason we have struggles with Christian liberty, is because too often we look at my personal liberty as the end goal. And so then when something comes along and someone is doing something different, or there's a challenge, or you know, things we're going to look at in the next two, the rest of the session, the next one, things of issues of wisdom and the weaker brother and things like that, we struggle, because when I've made what I want to do be the end of everything, my enjoyment of everything, we have a problem. Christ in Matthew 22 says this, where a man comes to him and says, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." You know, here in this statement, Christ says that the law, the end, is to love the Lord our God with all of our heart, soul, and mind, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. The Catechism puts it, to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Those are the ends of our life, not our enjoyment of the things that God has given us. When God has given us a gift, whatever that may be, whether it's some of the things that we've talked about or so many other areas of this life, when God has given them to us, it is great to enjoy them. And in fact, to treat them in a Gnostic way as if somehow they're bad because they're part of this world, or to, in an ascetic way, that somehow I have become more spiritual because I stopped doing them, is to scorn the work of Christ and the gift of God. But at the same time, we must always keep everything within the context to remember that our freedom is still bound by what God has commanded and our encouragement to love our neighbor. Galatians 5 talks about freedom, but in this context, Paul says, "For you are called to freedom, brothers, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another." What is Paul saying? He's saying enjoy your freedom, but don't make your freedom and the enjoyment of your flesh the end. Rather, use your freedom for your neighbor. Love and serve one another. And that's an important aspect for us to think about as we go through. I want to give one last, some last checks for us to think about as before we get into the issue of wisdom. There's three checks that we can help keep us from abusing what God has given. There is the issue that we need to, and actually I messed up my notes here. I'm about to skip that section. The point is to love the Lord, love our neighbor, and to be wise as we do things. One last thing that I want to say about liberty. I'm going to wait until the last session. I think we're good. What I want to move into now is the issue of wisdom. And the wisdom is one of the most important aspects that we can think about as we think through this. Wisdom really drives the issue. If we think about antinomianism and legalism, the unifying feature is a lack of wisdom. Now, it's done in different ways. For antinomianism, the idea is either a presumption of wisdom or a disregard for wisdom. Basically, who cares? I can do what I want. There are no consequences. And legalism doesn't want to have to wrestle through things. It's a whole lot easier to obey rules than it is to actually wrestle through things. Michael Horton likes to say that man is wired for law. And what he means is that we desire law by nature. We desire rules because rules help us understand how to do things. The illustration I like to give is our U.S. Road system or road laws or driving laws. One of the things that's been interesting as I've studied that, and I haven't studied it in depth, but just read stuff about it, most of our laws, traffic laws, are geared towards one purpose, and that is deciding who's at fault if there's an accident. That's really the only thing that matters the way our laws are set up. You think about defensive driving. What is defensive driving? Defensive driving is driving in a manner that keeps you from being in an accident, even if the other person's at fault. You know, being aware, yes, I may have the right of way, but he's being an idiot, so let me get out of the way. That's, in a nutshell, defensive driving. But here's the thing. The point is that theoretically under our system, you could actually cause accidents repeatedly and have no consequences because you obeyed the law. If you do everything by the book, even if you asserted your will and yes, that person, you had an opportunity to avoid that person, but I have the right of way, so let them get out of the way. When the courts or the insurance companies or whatever are asserting who's at fault, they're going to say the other person because you did what was by the book. And the problem with that is, in just a practical term, is what I've just made. That's why we have so much on defensive driving in our world, because on the one hand, having rules and having everything by the book helps the insurance company. It helps establish who's at fault, but it doesn't actually prevent accidents. For that, we need to be wise, and we need to exercise defensive driving. And that's the point of Christian liberty, and especially as we think about wisdom. So often, the reason that we like rules is because they make things simple. If I keep the rule, then I think, well, I've accomplished it. I've done what I'm supposed to do. I've met the rule, and the rules are always set up to where they're easy to keep. But the actual law of God is not easy to keep. In fact, the emphasis of the New Testament is that we all fail, and when we fail at one point, we're guilty of it all. And the point is not to make us feel comfortable in our failure, but to remind us of just how much we need Christ. And so we need to think through this, and from a variety of aspects of where wisdom really is the counterbalance both to antinomianism and legalism. Many years ago, my brother was involved in a dialogue with a pastor and over some issues of Christian liberty, and at one point in the conversation, so the pastor made the point that my brother's view was what he called subjective Christianity, and his view was objective Christianity. And he clarified that by saying, in my view, myself and my children and everybody in my church can do the same thing because we all have the same rule. We all have the same thing. That's objective, and what you're doing is subjective, and you'll have different people doing different things. And on the one hand, he's right. That's exactly the point. When we embrace Christian liberty, not everybody's going to do the same thing. We're going to have different viewpoints on how to apply the law of God, and that is fine. That is, again, what Scripture asserts, is don't get caught up in debates over all of those applications. Rather, emphasize what God has actually emphasized. But the reason that's a struggle is because it creates challenges, doesn't it? When we sit here as a church and we come together and we don't agree on everything, what happens when our child comes to us and says, can I do such and such? And we say no. And they say, but Susie's parents let her, or Johnny's parents let him. And they're the people you're sitting next to in church. And those are challenges, aren't they? When, it'd be a whole lot easier if we could come to church and I say no and every single other parent says no about the exact same thing. And hopefully there's some things that every parent in the church is saying no about. But there's going to be other things that they're not all saying the same thing about. And that creates challenges. It's difficult. It's and we have to wrestle through. We have topics where we come to them and we look at them and we don't always know how to handle them best, and we do so in wisdom the best we can. But it's going to be different at different times. And so on the one hand, if we think about legalism and antinomianism, antinomianism just casts off wisdom. It just says, I don't care about wisdom. I'm going to do what I want to do, and there's no consequences. Legalism focuses on what we might call the tyranny of the individual. It takes what I think things should be and forces that on others because it's easier. Wisdom is difficult. And that's what we want to spend most of this session on, is why wisdom is difficult, but why it is absolutely necessary, and why we are called to be wise in Scripture. Now, we can say the challenge of wisdom in a very familiar passage. Proverbs 26, verses 4 and 5 says this, "Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes." Now, there's some good treatments of this passage on when are we to answer, when are we to not, and things like that. The bottom line, though, is seemingly we have in back-to-back verses an absolute contradiction. One verse says answer, another verse says don't answer. The point is how do we know when? Well, it's wisdom. Proverbs, remember, Proverbs isn't a book of law. Proverbs is a book of wisdom. It's teaching us how to wrestle through things. And that's the point. It's not a simple, easy answer. We actually have to think about it, and we have to wrestle through it. There's a time to answer the fool. There's a time not to. It'd be really great in our law-wired minds if it said, answer not a fool when he meets all of these requirements, and then answer a fool when he meets all of these requirements. And the problem is we'd still probably find exceptions because nobody would match up with those specific things. And that's the point. We're given a simple statement that we then must apply wisdom to know how to wrestle through. And so wisdom, legalism is the tyranny of the individual. Antinomianism is the embracing of foolishness. Liberty is the embracing and the love of wisdom. That we come and we say, I'm going to be wise and I'm going to do what I can to do the right thing, and I'm going to let others have that same freedom, even if we in the end don't agree about how that should look. And so some of the things that we have to think about, we have to wrestle through. We have to think about self-control, moderation, temperance. What are those? How do they apply to various issues? We have questions like we see in the New Testament. When are we to be like Paul was with Titus and say, no, you're not circumcising him? And when do we have to be like Paul was with Timothy and say, I think you should go ahead and be circumcised? Those are issues of wisdom and liberty. There is no law in the New Testament for anybody to be circumcised. With Titus, Paul defended his freedom. With Timothy, he encouraged him to go ahead and give up his rights in order for the sake of the gospel. So when do we defer to the weaker brother? And when do we stand up to the Pharisee? These are questions that we have to wrestle with, and they're not easy to answer. And the reality is we're not always going to agree on how to do them. And that's part of the point, is that when we don't agree, we keep going. Now, one of the issues to think about is how do we view the law and its application to us? I mentioned a moment ago, what is self-control, moderation, and temperance? David Wilkerson, some of you are familiar with him. He passed away here a few years ago. He wrote a book entitled Sipping Saints on rejection of alcohol, but he made a statement in there. He says, it's about moderation and the statement often given, everything in moderation. And he made the statement, shall we also advocate moderate adultery? How about the moderate use of heroin or one or two acts of fornication, violence and sex in moderation? And what he's putting up is a common argument here. If we're going to say everything in moderation, what about all these other things? Well, it misses the point. It's not about everything in moderation. I think the better term is everything in self-control. How self-control looks in different situations is going to look different. Self-control without alcohol means moderation. Self-control with sex means only within marriage between a man and a woman. Self-control with violence means proper self-defense. It means don't seek out violence, don't hurt, you know, turn the other cheek, things like that. And each thing has its own aspect and own point that we want to look at. And the thing is how we wrestle through, and some of those, there are some gray areas in that we have to wrestle with, we have to struggle with. Some of them have very sharply and clear lines, and we need to be very adamant on those sharp and clear lines as well. So let's think about some of these things. Circumcision. Why did Paul tell Timothy to get circumcised and Titus not to? I think, first of all, we need to recognize that when he encouraged Timothy to get circumcised, it wasn't an order, as in, Timothy, I am binding your conscience, you must go get circumcised. It was still within Timothy's freedom not to be circumcised. But why did he do that? And why was Titus different? There's a variety of reasons for it, but at the core, I think the issue is the gospel. Timothy was encouraged to because of the setting in which he was in. Timothy was able to, by becoming circumcised, it allowed him to reach out and talk to certain people that he wouldn't have been able to if he wasn't circumcised. And so for the sake of the gospel, he gave up his right not to be circumcised in order to be circumcised so he could take the gospel to the people in that community. Titus is the exact opposite. The people that were trying to force him to be circumcised weren't doing so in a manner that was going to mean the gospel would go to them. They were doing so because they were perverting the gospel. And allowing Titus to be circumcised would have subverted the gospel and actually reinforced anti-gospel attitudes by the Judaizers there in Galatia. And that's why Paul in Galatians makes the issue out of that. No, I didn't allow it. Of course, it's back in Jerusalem where that took place. But when he's talking to Galatians, that's why he didn't allow this to happen, because I'm not going to allow the gospel to be upended by the denial of Christian liberty. Now, again, as we're going through life, we can look back and we can see how Paul explains it. We can say, oh, that's why Timothy was circumcised and that's why Titus wasn't. But when we're confronted with those issues in our churches, it's not always clear-cut. And it's not always as straightforward when we're dealing with somebody that we need to be patient with and sacrifice for a moment, and when we just need to stand up and say, no, you're a Pharisee, as Christ does to the Pharisees in Matthew 10. They're blind leaders, the blind, let them alone. I don't care if I've offended them. They need to be offended. There's a time to do that. And so that's where wisdom comes in. And so let's think about wisdom for a little bit. I want to just start by this. Think about how much of Scripture is devoted to wisdom. You know, we want to emphasize the law of God, but think about how much is devoted to wisdom. There's an entire corpus, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, are all, what, wisdom books. There's a book in the New Testament. James is another book of wisdom. And each of these books emphasizes the importance of wisdom in our lives. And it's important for us to think about how much this is important. Now, there's all kinds of aspects of things that we can think about this. There's the fact that ultimately all of these point to Christ, who is the personification of wisdom. He is wisdom. And there's issues like that, and we could spend all kinds of time thinking about the Christological center of the wisdom corpus. But there's also just the practical, that we are called to be wise, to seek wisdom. Now, the first thing we can think about with wisdom is that what we see in Proverbs 9 and other places, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. And again, this kind of goes back to how we ended the last session. How do we end it? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. That's the core. We're not going to be truly wise unless we, first of all, fear the Lord and desire Him. Now think about that for a moment, though, in contrast with legalism and antinomianism. Antinomianism was without fear. I have no fear. There's no consequences. Christ paid the price of the cross. I'm going to heaven. I can live however I want. Legalism lives in constant fear because it's afraid of how others are going to perceive us, how we are going to do that. Am I going to get to heaven okay? Am I going to have the right standing before God? Are the people that are binding my consciences going to talk to me if I don't do what I've been called to do? And it lives in constant fear. Wisdom focuses on the fear of the Lord and then can live life with peace and hope, striving to be wise but trusting in the Lord in all things. The Antinomian then is foolish because it presumes mercy and protection. We might put it this way, living without caution or living without wisdom is not living by faith. There's a mantra that's gone around the past couple of years that really bothers me, especially because of how it's been used. Fear not faith, or fear, or faith over fear, or fear, faith not fear. There's a problem with that, and that is, yes, we're not to live in fear, we're to live in faith. But so often when people are saying that, it's because they are not living in faith, they're living in presumption. Think about for a moment, what was one of the temptations of Christ? Satan takes him up on the pinnacle of the temple and says, throw yourself down and have faith that the Lord is going to protect you. And what is Christ's response? It's also written that you shall not tempt the Lord your God. Don't presume to be taken care of. Be wise. Proverbs twice, Proverbs 22:3 and 27:12, both say, the prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it. We need to be wise. We need to see the danger. And that's what antinomianism does, is it doesn't see the danger. It just goes on, and Scripture calls that foolishness. Proverbs 14 says, one who is wise is cautious and turns away from evil, but a fool is reckless and careless. The wise person doesn't just cruise through life. They actually seek out how to do what is right. When Christ says, you shall not test the Lord your God, what does he say? He's saying, don't go out and just do what you want to do and trust the Lord is going to take care of you. We're called to be wise. Now again, legalism on the other side, it foresees the evil, so to speak, but it seeks the answer elsewhere, seeks the answer in rules. And the problem is that's still not really wisdom, because there are times when what they're just choosing might be wise in a particular situation, but it won't necessarily be universally wise. So it's still not wisdom. It's just twisting things. It's seeing the evil, but trying to find an easy answer. It's going back to the traffic laws. Well, just so long as I obey the rules, everything's going to be fine. Well, maybe, maybe not. And we still can get ourselves in trouble. Now, we gravitate towards antinomianism or legalism because they're both relatively easy. Neither one of them has to wrestle with wisdom. Antinomian does what it wants. Legalism does what it's told. In neither case do I have to actually wrestle with things that are hard. Now, the thing about wisdom, though, is that it doesn't come naturally. Remember Paul talking about who's in the kingdom? He says there's not many wise. Unfortunately, I think too often in our world today, the assessment of most Christians is, I'm a Christian, therefore I'm wise. And Paul says, no, not many wise actually are in the kingdom. Think about the way the Proverbs speak about getting wisdom. Blessed is the one who finds wisdom and the one who gets understanding. Proverbs 4, get wisdom, get insight, do not forget, and do not turn away from the words of my mouth. The beginning of wisdom is this, get wisdom, and whatever you get insight. And we could go on and on with similar passages. What Proverbs emphasizes is that wisdom isn't innate. It is something we have to seek. We have to go learn wisdom. We have to grow in wisdom. We are not very wise naturally. Proverbs 16 says that wisdom is better than gold, and to get understanding is to be chosen rather than silver. Now, what's the imagery there? He's saying it's more valuable than gold and silver, but especially emphasizing the way in which we seek gold and silver. If it's something worth seeking like gold and silver, it's something to go out and achieve. But the assumption is, like gold and silver, I don't have it. So I need to go acquire it. I need to go learn it. And that's part of the reason, again, why we run from these things, because of how challenging it can be to be wise. James speaks much of wisdom. And I think I'm going to skip over the section I have here on James just due to time today. But James 3, verses 13 through 17, again, calls Christians to be wise and to exercise godly wisdom and not the foolishness of this world. And then goes through a big thing. That's one of the things I might mention is he emphasizes in this that godly wisdom is peaceable, gentle. Think about this, open to reason and impartial. And I would ask us to think about, do we really see that in the church today, those four things? Do we really see our wisdom as peaceable, gentle, open to reason, and impartial? I would say actually all four of those things are the exact opposite of what we see most Christians exercising in our world today. But that's what James says is godly wisdom. Now, on the one hand, we need to affirm and emphasize that Christ is the fountain of wisdom. Colossians 2, 2 through 3, there it is, begins that great section on liberty, reminds us that of the need for wisdom, but first of all, that Christ is the fountain of wisdom, which is Christ in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And so Christ is the fountain of wisdom, and only true wisdom is found in him. But we do need to remember, and we need to be careful, and I won't spend a lot of time on this morning. There's two aspects of this that we need to be careful with. Christ is the fountain of all wisdom. He is true wisdom. But that does not mean that Christians are innately wise, and that if you're not a Christian, you are innately, or that you're not wise at all. There is much wisdom to be found in the people of this world, as wisdom is part of common grace, and there's a lot of very foolish Christians, which is why we have to seek wisdom. We have to learn wisdom. We have to grow in wisdom. If it was natural, if we just got saved and we're all of a sudden wise, James wouldn't have to warn us. But the fact is we don't have wisdom naturally. Now, let's think about some other aspects of this. We have to be careful not just clinging to rules or saying that whatever I want to do is fine. Now, a few years ago, if you'll take out in your the bulletins, there should be a sheet of paper there that I asked to be printed for this. And this is an interesting study. The Journal of Personality and Social Psychology did this study a few years ago, and I first became aware of this from a book that I would recommend by Thomas Nichols. Unskilled and unaware of it, how difficulties in recognizing one's own The book is The Death of Expertise by Thomas Nichols. That's another book that I would highly recommend. It's not a Christian book. I don't think Nichols would claim to be a Christian. But it deals with how we have lost our ability to learn in our world and learn from those who actually know things about things. But he referred to this article, and then I found out my co-elder actually had the journal article, and so I got it from him. But it's the journal article is entitled Unskilled and Unaware of It, How Difficulties in Recognizing One's Own Incompetence Lead to Inflative Self-Assessments. So they took four tests, and they gave them. The one you have there is the one on perceived logical reasoning ability. And they did one on math and a couple of other subjects. And they gave these people these tests. And so there's three things they were doing. They have the test score. They have how that person, so they get them taking the test and they'd ask them, how do you think you did on the test? What score do you think you got? And then they would say, and do you think that score is reflective of where you actually are? So do you think you did better than your test score? Or you know more than what your test score reflects, or less, or whatever. So those are the three things on here. So if you'll note at the beginning, the top line is how people perceive themselves. So this isn't, and then the middle line, the checkered one there, is their, what they thought their test score was. And then the lighter line is what their actual test scores were. So look at the first percentile, the 10th percentile there, the first group. Their test scores are at the absolute bottom, and yet their perception is that they're in the 70th percentile for logical reasoning ability. And I'm probably not quite. The test scores probably aren't going to reflect how smart I am, but it's probably in the 60th percentile for my actual test scores when they're actually in the 10th. Now, what's really fascinating is when you get over to the people that are actually in the 90th percentile, they actually scored better than they perceived themselves. And that's really the way wisdom works. The more we actually know, the less we realize we know. The more self-confident we are, usually the more ignorant we are. And this is a challenging thing. I think this is part of the problem that we have with wisdom. I think it's one of the things that we have to wrestle with when we are wrestling with wisdom. Wisdom isn't innate. I don't just wake up one day and say, I'm wise. We don't just, I'm born, I'm an American, I'm a Christian, I'm whatever else you want to descriptor you want to put in, therefore I'm wise. Wisdom has to be worked at. We have to learn. We have to first recognize that innately I'm probably not very wise, and I need help. And so I think as we wrestle through and we work on this topic, it's important for us to work on wisdom. So how do we learn wisdom? Well, one of the first things we can do is listen to others. Proverbs 18 says, whoever isolates himself seeks his own desires. He breaks out against all sound judgment. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion. We have a lot of people in our world today that only want to express their own opinion. They don't want to listen. They don't want to actually hear others. And that's part of the thing, is listening to others. We're told elsewhere in Proverbs that there's wisdom in a multitude of counselors. Now, we need to be careful with that in a couple of different areas. One is, just because you have 10 people saying something doesn't make it right. We can get a whole panel of fools that'll all say the same thing, that none of them know what they're talking about, and they're not helping. The other thing is, and this is, I think, the more common problem, is where we seek a multitude of counselors, but we're not actually seeking counsel. We're seeking confirmation. I see this all the time. I know John has seen this all the time, where people will start, I'll have people come to me for counseling, and then I find out I'm the 10th person they've been to, and they're going to keep going until they find that one pastor will say, yes, you're right, you should do this. That's not seeking counsel. That's seeking confirmation. And that's not wise. That's not wisdom. Now, counselors are not binding. And this is an important aspect. When counsel is given, it is counsel. It is not binding upon the conscience. And that's part of the point. So we seek counsel. We get help. I had a man years ago who kept coming for counsel. And every time that he'd come to me for counsel, I'd give him counsel, and he'd go out and do the exact opposite, and things would just absolutely blow up in his face. And he finally came to me one day, and we're talking about that. I was kind of challenging him. He's like, well, I didn't think your counsel was binding. I said, it's not. And on the one hand, if it was one or two times, I would say, okay, that's fine. But the fact that you every single day, he told me, well, I do that intentionally, because I told my fiance that your counsel's not binding, and so we need to learn how to do things on our own. I'm thinking, but then why are you coming to me for counsel? If you're coming to me for counsel with the intention that you're not going to do what I'm counseling, then why are we wasting our time? And secondly, if every single time that you decide to do it your own way, it goes horribly wrong, maybe you want to reconsider whether your wisdom is actually guiding you in a good direction or not. Now, that's not to say that my wisdom in every one of those situations is right. It may not have been. My wisdom is definitely fallible, and I have many times in my life given bad counsel. I receive bad counsel. We will counsel each other poorly. That's why the multitude of counsel is helpful, so that we can begin to get that bigger picture. You know, if everybody's saying, and we got a bunch of wise counselors all saying the same thing, it's probably a good idea that they're probably speaking the right thing. If we have a variety, then we have to wrestle through even more. But seek counsel. But actually, seek counsel. It's not binding, but listen to it, learn from it, and actually seek people who have the wisdom to actually help, to guide. An aspect of this is, don't live in an echo chamber. This is a real problem. It's a term from our current world, but it's an important one. When we live in a world where everybody just says the same thing and all the things that we want to hear, we don't get challenged. We need to get out, and we need to listen outside of our echo chamber. One of the more interesting stories to me in Scripture is found in 1 Kings 22. We won't read this whole passage. Just kind of recount the story. Some of you are aware of this. Jehoshaphat, or King Ahab, is trying to get King Jehoshaphat. So Ahab is ruler of the 10 northern kingdoms or tribes. Ahab's ruler of the northern tribes, Jehoshaphat of the southern tribes. Ahab's getting ready to go out and fight the Assyrians. He wants Jehoshaphat to go with him. And so they get a bunch of counselors together, a bunch of prophets, to give them counsel as to whether they should go out or not. And all these people come in, and they're just yes men for Ahab, and they all come in and say, yes, go fight. And Jehoshaphat shows a modicum of biblical wisdom and says, do we have anybody that actually is speaking for God and not just a bunch of people are telling you what you want to hear? And Ahab, yeah, there's one, but I hate him. Why? Because he always says the things that I don't want to hear. So they go get Micaiah, and Micaiah comes, and what do they tell Micaiah? By the way, everybody else has said, go fight. So you should say the same thing. So Micaiah says, sure. Gets in there. The Lord spoke to me. He said, go fight. He's going to give it to you. Everything's fine. And Ahab looks at him and says, quit lying. I know it's not what God told you. Go ahead and tell me the truth. And so Micaiah says, okay, you want the truth? You go fight today, you're going to die. God's going to kill you. And sure enough, a little while later, it's exactly what happened. Of course, the fascinating thing in that story is Jehoshaphat made sure he had a counselor from the Lord. The counselor from the Lord came and said, don't go, and Jehoshaphat went anyway. Now, Jehoshaphat did live, but Ahab didn't. And it's always a fascinating story to me on this topic of counsel, especially as you see, you've got the one counselor talks about, he puts the horns on his head, and God's going to use you like these horns to push the Assyrians out of the land. And all of this just foolishness in counsel, because they weren't actually interested in giving good counsel. And then God really uses Micaiah as his prophet to really just turn all that on its head and say, here's just the one man, but the one man whose integrity was such that, no, I'm going to tell you what God has said. But then leaves it up to them. And Ahab and Jehoshaphat went out anyway, and Ahab died. A bowman at a venture fired an arrow, and Ahab died. Now, the thing I want to think about real briefly with all of this and wisdom before we close for this session is the subjective nature of wisdom. Now, this is a challenging idea, challenging concept. There is nothing subjective about true wisdom. Christ is the fountainhead of wisdom. There is no variation in him or in what true wisdom is. In every situation, there is an absolute right and an absolute wrong in how it should be handled. When I say subjective, my point is that only Christ will get it right in every single situation. What is necessary to make good decisions? Let's think about some of the things that are necessary to make good decisions. One, you need to have all the information. Two, you need to have all of the available outcomes. And three, exactly how to apply the information that you have, both of what's going on now and the possible outcomes. Let me ask you a question. How many of you have known all three of those things in any decision in your life? I'm glad I'm seeing no hands raised. Why? First of all, we rarely know all the information about the present situation. We know some of the things that we can see, but if I'm dealing with somebody else, I don't know what's in their head. I don't know what they're going through, what their background is, what's informing them in the situation. I have no clue what tomorrow holds, how they're going to respond to things, and how it's going to unfold as things come to a head. And so therefore, all I am doing is if I'm being wise, is I'm applying patterns. But I'm recognizing there's all kinds of variables here that I just don't have an answer for. Only Christ has that answer. And see, the other side of this is the fact that because of all those variables, two situations that look similar won't be the same at all. Just think about raising children for a moment. How many children in a family are identical? And I don't mean identical in the fact they look alike because they're twins. I mean in the personalities and how they handle things and how they handle correction and instruction and guidance. Why is parenting so hard at times? Because what worked for this child doesn't work for this child. And we struggle with that tension and that difficulty, and how do we handle? And this child, when we do this, they get angry. And this child, when we do the same thing, they come and give us a hug. And we wrestle back and forth, and we try to learn, and we try to adapt and try to grow, but everybody's different. And so this is why we cannot come along and make a mandatory, everybody must do things the exact same way, because we don't have all the variables. And so there is a subjective nature to our experience of wisdom, because we don't know all the variables in any situation, even for ourselves, let alone for what our neighbor is going through. So there are things that we can come along and we can say, no, that is the wrong thing to do because it is sin. And there's some things we can look at and say, that's pretty foolish. And let's think about why it's foolish. But largely we have to say in the end, if it's not sin, then you have to make that decision and answer to God or the circumstances for how it goes. And that's the core of Christian liberty. And I, on the one hand, we spend a lot of time talking about wisdom and the fact to learn wisdom, because I think I'm seeing a lot of people in our world begin to embrace this idea, and they think, well, I am wise, so therefore whatever decision I make is fine. Instead of recognizing, no, I need to learn wisdom. But then we get the other way and we say, well, I am wise, and you're not doing things the way I would, so therefore you're foolish. And that's not necessarily the case either. We have to strive towards wisdom, but at the same time show grace to others. At the same time recognize that there is a subjective nature. We're not always going to land on the same position on things. We're not always going to come to the same point in a variety of areas. And we seek counsel, and we seek wisdom, and we try to grow, but we, in the end, show grace. So wisdom challenges us not to presume upon mercy. Don't test the Lord. Don't think you can live any way you want. It challenges us to wrestle through things, but it also challenges not just to default to law. Okay, I don't want to think about this, so tell me what to think. I've had a lot of people come to me, and I'm sure John has too, in the ministry. You know, tell me what to do. Well, I can't tell you what to do. I can give you things to think about. You have to decide what to do. And we like so often, just tell me what to do and make it simple. But then what happens? As soon as they say what to do and then it doesn't go the way we want it to, then, well, you told me to do this. No, we're each responsible for what works out in our situation. That's why we need to wrestle through. Don't just ask somebody, tell me what to do, but think about it. Get wisdom, learn, and grow. But here's the final part of that I want us to think about. And this is where we really think of, we need to really think about this in the nature of how we wrestle through things and the nature of Christian liberty. We started off again, Calvin, if we don't understand liberty, we will constantly live in fear. How many of you can affirm that even 25% of your decisions were perfectly wise in your life? Can any of us say that 1% of our decisions were perfectly wise? We can't, can we? They're always mixed. And we can look back over our lives and we can see where we've made mistakes. Where does the peace come from? So on the one hand, we said we got to have Christian liberty so we can have peace. But all of a sudden now we're saying be wise, and we realize we're not wise. Where does our peace come from? Well, it goes back to our first section, justification by grace through faith alone. Here's the thing. No matter how wise you are, you're not wise enough to earn heaven. But no matter how foolish your decision is, if you are in Christ, you still have heaven. And that's where our hope rests. Be wise, grow in wisdom, learn wisdom, seek wisdom like gold, seek wisdom like silver. But at the same time, find comfort in the Savior. It is not our work that redeems us. It is His. So the challenge is be wise, work at wisdom, but trust the Lord. Okay, we're actually ending that section right on time. I skipped a little bit. We'll come back, I guess, in 10 minutes, and we'll finish our last section and think about liberty and the weaker brother.